assume this is working. Okay, this is probably going to be sort of a weird talk. So I have something like a title, which is predictions for the deformation quantization of hyperkähler cones. From superconformal field theory. And I'm roughly going to try to spend some first period of time describing sort of the supersymmetric conformal field theory setup that leads to some algebraic problem, that sort of the precise form of that problem is natural from the point of view of physics, although I'm not sure it would have been natural from the point of view of pure mathematics. And then I'm going to use the way that that problem comes up to make some statements about unassociated math problem and make some predictions that I don't really know how to do anything with, but I think they're interesting. So part of what's going to make this talk weird is that I don't really know exactly what has gone down in the discussions and as a part of this like series of talks before now. So I'll try to sort of give general sketches of things that maybe people have already talked about. So the quantum field theories that play a role and what I'm going to talk about are three-dimensional theories with n equals 4 supersymmetry. And I think this has been the subject of these meetings. And probably, at least last week, if Tudor told me correctly, you heard about sort of what would be the usual presentation of these kinds of theories, where you introduce things like quantum fields, Lagrangians, and path integrals, and do various standard physics manipulations with them to learn things about these physical systems or maybe some related mathematics. And this is some kind of a UV construction of a quantum field theory where you introduce weakly coupled fields. But then something interesting happens at long distances where you have strongly interacting physics in the infrared. And in the IR, we expect that if you didn't turn on any mass terms or something that will ruin things for you, then the kinds of things that you write down with these Lagrangians will end up being described by some superconformal field theory. And these, at least if you want them to be, are sort of more algebraic objects in that they obey a bunch of algebraic rules that we think are strong enough in order to do something with them without worrying a whole lot about the original path integral description. So that's going to be my point of view in general, and that's what's going to lead to some interesting algebra problem after looking at things the right way. So in particular, the origin of this algebraic niceness is that there's some superconformal symmetry that controls these theories, which in this case is OSP 4/2. So this contains SO4 R symmetry times SO4 comma 1 conformal symmetry if you're in Euclidean signature, which I will be, where this is usually written as something called SU2 Higgs times SU2 Coulomb, where the labels Higgs and Coulomb or something that sort of owes to the description up here. But if you're working down here, there's sort of no important invariant difference. It's just two different SU2s. And this contains an SO3 times SO1 comma 1, where this is the rotation group in three dimensions. This is dilatation symmetry. So from the algebraic point of view, important objects in one of these theories are the local operators. So these are things that generically will be called something like OI of X that are labeled by some point in space-time where you can insert them. And these things live in unitary irreducible representations of this superconformal algebra. So in particular, they're labeled by these are some highest weight representations. And so we can label those representations by some charges of the highest weight states, which will be called delta JR1 and R2. Where delta is the so-called conformal dimension, which is the eigenvalue under rescalings. J is some spin under the SO3 rotation group, and R1 and R2 are spins with respect to these two SU2s. And so one thing that we sometimes say is that sort of knowing the list of these operators and their representations, which are present in a given theory, is sort of like the kinematics problem. So the structure of these representations is just determined by symmetry, and there's some list. So in particular, we usually have, from this UV description, you usually have some sense of what the J's, R1's, and R2's are for the operators that are around in your theory. But for the most part, these real numbers, delta, that characterize these things, are big mysteries. So for the vast majority of operators in one of these theories, you just don't know what those numbers are. And then if this is kinematics, then the dynamics is encoded in the operator product expansion, which allows you to determine correlation functions in these theories. So this is this algebraic structure, which is powerful in these theories. So I'm going to be generally very schematic in that operators, because they carry these extra quantum numbers, have like some indices on them that have to do with where they are in their SU2R and SU2 or SO3 space-time representations. I'm always going to suppress those and act like all operators are scalars. But if you're paying attention to symmetry, you can soup things up and include all the extra indices. So the OPE says that if you have two operators that are close to each other, then you replace them with a new sum of local operators. In principle, this is a sum over all the operators K that are in your theory. So you can replace pairs with single operators, where these are actually functions of the positions. But the form of these functions of the positions are completely determined by symmetry, although I won't write down what they look like. So that all the interesting information in this is contained in pure numbers, which are the coefficients, the numerical coefficients of certain functions of the positions that I'm not writing down. And another way of saying it is that the structure of this operator product expansion is encoded in just knowing the 3 and 2 point functions of your theory. The 3 point functions form as a position of, as a function of positions x, y, and z is completely determined up to symmetry, or by symmetry up to some numerical coefficient, which is now this Cijk, something like x minus y to the delta 1 plus delta 2 minus delta 3 times permutations. And the 2 point functions define some sort of metric on the space of local operators. And this is now all the information. So in conformal field theories, the power of conformal symmetry is that if you know the list of local operators and you know these numbers, these pure numbers, which are some privileged numbers, and you also know this metric, although if you want to, you can renormalize your operators or set their normalization so that this metric is just the delta function. Then you can compute arbitrary endpoint correlators, because you can take the operators 2 by 2 and replace them with a sum of new guys, where these OPE coefficients are completely determined by these things, and do that over and over again until you've got nothing left. And you just have a pure number or a pure function of space-time. So all the information in these conformal field theories is contained in these sort of structure constants of this operator algebra in this metric. And the hope, sort of the algebraic program behind studying CFTs in this language, is that somehow consistency of this algebraic framework is going to be enough to do something useful for you. So in particular, this kind of product needs to be associative. That associativity condition will impose non-trivial constraints on these numbers. And usually, the window into this associativity is to look at the four-point function. So if I put down four operators in space-time, and I want to evaluate this four-point function, one thing to do is to take these two pairs, expand them in pairs of local operators, and then expand those subsequent pairs in terms of pure numbers. But I could have also done it the other way, this way first. And that imposes some non-trivial constraints. We call that crossing symmetry. And this is, in principle, probably some very constraining algebraic framework. But for the most part, it's intractable. So for general conformal field theories, all of this would say, I haven't used n equals 4 superconformal symmetry really at all yet. And there's a lot of work on trying to do something useful with these associativity conditions, just as I've stated them, plus all the details. But it's very hard. And for the moment, most of the work is like numerical and dirty. So the thing that I want to do with supersymmetry is find some way of taking this general idea that there's some sort of powerful associative algebra problem related to conformal field theories and transport it into some nicer setting where I can focus on some more restricted subsector of my theory that's better controlled by supersymmetry and then do something useful with that. So the usual setting for getting nice consequences of supersymmetry is focusing on so-called BPS operators. So in particular, in terms of these quantum numbers that I mentioned before, there are two types of BPS operators. These are just certain types of representations of OSP4/2. There are Higgs-type operators whose conformal dimension is equal to their spin with respect to the first of the R symmetries. And the other spins are 0. And then the alternate one. So these are some very special operators in your theory. Most operators are not of this type, but these are the nicest ones. The thing that does the work behind the scenes in terms of talking about these operators and being able to say more concrete things is that the R symmetry highest weight states in these representations are annihilated by half of the fermionic generators of the symmetry. And that does work for you. In particular, one of the consequences of that is that these rings, or these operators, commutative rings can define either as the short distance limit of the operator product expansion. So if you take two operators of this type, and you take this OPE, but now you look at the small x minus y limit, then there will be a leading term which has no suppression. So it's just some operator that appears with no dependence on x minus y. And then you'll see subleading terms that depend like x minus y to a positive power. And so if you drop all the terms that depend like x minus y to a positive power, then you get these. Then you get another one of these EPS operators. And this is some commutative associative ring. Alternatively, if you don't want to take the short distance limit, you can define this as the OPE modulo Q exact terms. So these Qs, the supercharges that annihilate the appropriate operators, you can define a cohomology with respect to them. You know, if you work modulo things that are exact in that cohomology, then again, you get some commutative ring. And this now lets you get a little bit more geometric instead of just working purely in terms of operator algebras. Because as it happens, so let me call these commutative rings chiral rings. And from now on, because I haven't paid any attention to the UV descriptions, and so I'm not drawing any important distinction between Higgs and Coulomb, I'm just going to talk about the chiral ring. Assume that I'm talking about one of the two, and the other one I'm not going to care about. So the chiral ring, this commutative ring, is the coordinate ring on some hypercalar cone, which is part of the moduli space of vacua of these theories, which I think is a thing that has appeared in previous weeks. So these quantum numbers, delta, or r, which are the same for these BPS operators, correspond to the C star grating induced by the fact that a hypercalar cone is a cone. So there's a C star action, which just contracts or expands it. And so any function on it has some C star grating. And the SU2 rotations, because these things live in some SU2R multiplet, then corresponds to the SU2 isometry, which is present for any hypercalar cone. So there's some beginning of a map between geometry and these operator algebras.
But isn't that C star and the SU2 thing?
Yeah, yeah. The C star is the Cartan. So this is just an extension of this statement. Okay, in terms of, so here's some structure which I claim to know, and I'm not going to demonstrate it. But so now I claimed to be very preoccupied with these particular numbers. So you can ask what sorts of elements of this sort of set of interesting numbers am I getting from knowing about this commutative ring? And it's not hard to see that the structure constants of the ring, so say I have, this is now writing down multiplication in the ring. Where fj, fi, fj, fk are functions on the ring, or functions on the hypercalar cone. This cijk is equal to this thing that I called cijk before. IJL, eta, okay. So this is some combination of the two-point functions and the three-point functions. In the special case that, let me introduce a notation. Where when I talk about the norm of an index, what I mean is the C star grading of the operator or the function, which is labeled by that index. And so I'll always assume that I'm working in homogeneous subspaces for all the things I write down. Otherwise, you just extend by linearity. So this is for some particular choices of operators, so that when I take two guys, I pick a third guy whose C star grading is just the addition of the previous two. And then for those particular choices of triplets of operators, I can say something about these combinations of the three-point functions and the two-point functions. So that's just what I got for free just by knowing this fact about commutative rings. So a natural question, well, to some people it might be natural, is, given that I've said that there are these nice operators which have something to do with geometry, and given that I've said that I'm interested in these kinds of three-point functions and two-point functions, can I say something about more general three-point functions where not exactly this condition is imposed, but still between these special operators? So I'd like to know something about Cijk between a general triplet of these operators. So in particular, in this case, the only condition is that a triangle inequality is obeyed. And that's because these C star gratings are actually gratings with respect to an SU2. So these are spins. So this is just the addition of angular momentum that can be between the norm of the difference in the sum. So there's some larger set of these three-point functions. These are some interesting numbers associated with these three-dimensional CFTs, presumably also associated with these geometries. And then the goal is to say something about them. But none of the ultra standard things that you can do with these sort of chiral ring constructions immediately gives you these numbers. So the rest of the talk will be a story about how to get those numbers, or how to say what framework those numbers exist within. So I'm just going to make a physics-based claim without going into the details unless prompted, which is that you can find a nilpotent fermionic symmetry generator inside of the superconformal algebra, which I like to call Q. Maybe I'll even put a sub zeta on it, which schematically is of the form Q plus zeta S, where this Q is a particular example of one of these fermionic supercharges that previously made an appearance over here in terms of identifying these chiral operators. And this S is the superconformal sort of counterpart of that Q, which is only present in superconformal theories, not in generic supersymmetric theories. So I'm avoiding writing it down because I've been told that writing things with explicit indices is anathema to certain mathematical audiences. But if anyone wants to know what the index labels are on these things, I'll give it to you. So the claim is that there's some supercharge of this form that you can find that's nilpotent. And so you're going to start looking for cohomologies that you can define. It has the following properties. So the Q closed but not exact local operators with respect to this thing have the following form. Remember that I'm in three dimensions. The choice of the precise indices that go into the definition of this thing single out a line inside of my three-dimensional spacetime. In the operators that give me non-trivial cohomology elements with respect to this Q, let me call the coordinate along this line S, are operators inserted at some point S of a particular form. And here, I can't help but write indices because I don't know how else to write this. So remember that these O's, so I should have said these are twisted versions of these BPS operators I defined before. In particular, what I was talking about before were the R-symmetry highest weight states of these things. Now, I'm going to take something that starts out with the highest weight state in this R-symmetry multiplet, and then add explicit position-dependent correction terms So this is some perverse looking thing to do, but if I had actually given you the details of what this Q is and why this is true, it would look slightly less perverse. But this is some sort of funny, twisted translation prescription. So the kinds of operators I'm looking at are ones that at the origin, where S is zero, would look like my familiar guys, but now there's some funny prescription for how I move them around on this line. Or spin? These guys are all scalars.
Yes, that's what I'm asking. You don't find any fermions?
No. So these are all, so if you ask for what operators you can legally put at the origin, they are precisely the half BPS operators. And then if you try to move them away.
So you can find operators that are killed by half the supercharges just by looking at a single Q plus data.
Yes. And now, if I work with these objects that give me nice cohomology elements, and I define the operator product expansion, I mean, it's already defined. It's just whatever my whatever sort of the extant operator product expansion for these operators was, but now written for these particular guys. And I work modulo things that are Q exact. Then I get something which is S independent that cares about ordering. So if I have a pair of operators, O of S1 and O of S2, and I want to take their OPE, it doesn't matter how far apart they are from each other, as long as I keep one guy to the right of the other guy, as long as I don't have them cross any other things that happen to be around. So this tells me that my OPE, which originally was some very complicated, hard to parse operator algebra that depended on lots of things, will just become a not necessarily commutative associative algebra. With some sort of operation we'll come back to later, which is like an evaluation map, because I can take correlation functions. So that should correspond to some action on this algebra. And finally, something that isn't hard to see once you write these guys out and take the OPEs is if you take the zeta to zero limit, then this should just become this chiral ring again. So zeta is some deformation parameter, which is deforming the chiral ring, which was the coordinate ring on this hyperkähler cone, into some non-commutative associative thing. And then the hope, if you have the kinds of hopes that we've learned to have with respect to this sort of algebraic conformal field theory business, is that associativity, the associativity conditions on this deformation, will fix the structure constants. That's what you would hope is true. And if that's the case, then you're going to have a way to generate these things, because these structure constants, again, for the more general case, are precisely the structure constants of this non-commutative associative algebra once you unpack everything. So, good. This basically gets to the end of the physics part, which I was intentionally extremely sketchy about. So I hope people won't blame me and they'll ask me if anyone cares about where any of this really came from. But the point is that now I get to the point where I have essentially a pure associative algebra problem. I have some problem where, for many purposes, I can sort of forget about the underlying physics, although I'll mention some consequences of the underlying physics again later, but in the language just of a pure associative algebra problem. As an associative algebra problem, This is deformation quantization of a hypercalic cone. I haven't actually, I didn't include it in my notes, so I don't want to go into it. But the thing that should really lead me to say the words deformation quantization is not just that the zeta to zero limit of this thing is this commutative ring, but that the leading order correction, sort of the order zeta term in this deformed product, is controlled by the Poisson bracket on this hypercalic cone. And that's true. I'm not going to explain why.
Do you have the fundamental?
It's R proof. It's the descent proof. I think it's probably you can even get away without doing that, because I think it's the case. Well, someone hopefully will correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I read somewhere in the literature that if you ask, so any deformation quantization at leading order, just associativity, requires that the leading order term be a Poisson bracket, and if you ask that it be C star equivariant, which I'm going to say in a minute. That means there's going to be a Poisson bracket of degree minus one on the hypercalic cone. And I think those are basically unique. But so I think you may just get it because it couldn't be anything else without being zero. So this is the world that we're in. Now this is like a subject that's studied by lots of smart people. That's the good news. So the good news is that this is well studied. And that there's actually a classification. Of these deformations, the classification is by H2 of the maximal resolution of this cone. The bad news is that in some sense it's the wrong classification. Because in the bulk of the literature, the work on classifications of these deformations works modulo something which is called a gauge symmetry, which involves giant changes of basis in your non-commutative algebra. And that will change the structure constants, although it will leave some invariant algebra under it invariant. But I claimed that I really care about structure constants. These are really some numbers that have no ambiguity. They're sort of interesting pure numbers. So I need some way to see that. So there should be something about this problem that sort of makes it so I don't want to work modulo those gauge transformations. I want to produce pure numbers. But then there's more good news, which is that compared to what would be sort of the standard setup of trying to find these non-commutative deformations, we have extra conditions that should be true. And hopefully, those will make it so these kinds of changes of basis are not such a bad thing. Wow, this board goes forever. So, now I want to do my best, hopefully without butchering it too badly, of saying what is the associative algebra problem that includes all the information that I know how to get out of this underlying conformal field theory construct. That I'm sort of led to, that then hopefully we'll have some nice theory behind it. So now I'm going to not say anything about the CFT. I'm just going to use things that came from it, and I can explain it if people ask, for a while. OK. So now I'm just going to talk about some algebra problem, where there are some suggestions about what the solutions of it might look like coming from physics. So the input of this algebra problem is some hypercalic cone. I'm going to assume that the hypercalic cone is an affine variety. Always true. True in all the instances that I know about that come from physics. Okay. It's at least the case that in an infinite class of examples that come from physics, it's an affine variety. So I know how to talk about its coordinate ring. I'll call A. It comes with a holomorphic Poisson bracket. -1. I'm going to carry some examples along with this. So my favorite hypercalar cone that I know is C2 mod Z2. There's another one that I know, which is C2 mod Z3, which is slightly less special. C2 mod Z2 has many special properties. So then these coordinate rings are just the way you realize them as varieties. Like this. Poisson bracket. For this case, it's just like SU2. These are totally standard. The next things, I think, are secretly standard, although I didn't know about them until I read them in papers by Davide. So I don't know how standard they really are. First is an anti-holomorphic involution on the cone, which amounts to sort of rotation by pi in this SU2 isometry. And then there's the induced action on the algebra that sends holomorphic functions to anti-holomorphic functions. This is C linear, even though it's anti-holomorphic. And then there's something that I'll call rho, which is the composition of this sigma star with complex conjugation. So this is a C antilinear involution on the algebra of holomorphic functions. And so in the examples, it's like this. You pick up a minus sign for the z, and you exchange x and y in C2 mod Z2. C2 mod Z3 is a little bit weirder because there's another minus sign, but it's not that weird. And the easiest way I know how to work this out is to realize these things as hypercalar quotients. And it's easy to do this transformation in C to the 4n. So you can do it that way, or C to the 2n. OK, so that's the data that goes into this problem. And now the thing that I want to do, should I stop going this way and come back that way? Now, the thing that I want to do is, given that information, I want to find some C star equivariant star product on A. So that if I take a function of degree D1, function of degree two, then I get FG, which is degree D1 plus D2 plus a half times the Poisson bracket, which is D1 plus D2 minus 1 plus dot 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 plus potentially some number times H bar to the D1 plus D2. And this should be associative. Ah, h bar over 2. Okay, and the standard thing that's where this good news about classification comes into play is that these kinds of deformations are the things that have been classified up to changes of the form a function of degree d1 getting replaced with h-bar corrections, with h-bar compensating the change in the dimension. So in principle, this is an infinite dimensional space of changes of bases. So there's an infinite dimensional quote unquote gauge symmetry acting on the structure constants of these algebras. And I don't like that, but that's something that naively is there if I'm just asking about solving this associativity problem. And then there are some conditions, which are the extra mileage that come out of physics that hopefully are important and useful. So the first one is not really revolutionary, because it's sometimes just imposed for niceness in the usual story. I can ask for this product to be something that's called even. Sometimes people call this parity symmetric. And that means that the terms that go like h bar to the even in this star product are symmetric under exchange of the two functions. And h bar to the odd are purely anti-symmetric. And this is something which is incorporated a little bit into the pre-existing results about these things. So in particular, it's known that requiring this, another way of saying this, maybe the fancier way of saying this, is that the opposite algebra at value minus h bar should be equal to the algebra with h bar. And it's known that this constrains the element, which I'll call p, inside of h2 of m tilde c that classifies these things. So there's some subspace, even before worrying about all of this gauge symmetry, there's some subspace of the solution's modulo gauge symmetry that have this condition. But then the next two conditions are unusual from the point of view of the standard story. So let me, in an abuse of notation compared to before, by P and AQ, I mean the Pth and Qth homogeneous subspaces of A with respect to the C star grading. And I want an element of weight P times an element of weight Q to live. So let me say that naively, in the general case, all that's true is that this will live in the part of weight less than p plus q. So this is maybe the usual story. But I want to impose this stronger condition, which means that in the h-bar expansion of these products, there's a premature truncation, which, again, should look like this kind of addition of angular momentum rule that we had before when I was talking about three-point functions, and it's coming from the same place. So this is what I want. And then third, there's a unitarity condition, which is related to unitarity of the underlying conformal field theory. And this imposes that if I take the constant term in the expansion of f with its transform under this involution rho that I introduced before, that this thing should be greater than 0. Just as an aside, this is the kind of thing that is fairly straightforward to like implement on a computer and get some reasonable looking subspace of solutions that obey this condition. This one is crazy. You find like nice linear subspaces of solutions that have this, and then this draws like crazy, imposing this draws like crazy curves and like subregions inside of the naive space of solutions that obey it. So there's something harder about that condition than the other conditions. So the thing that comes out of physics is that for any physical instance of this problem, so that means that, first of all, I need my hyperkähler cone to arise as the moduli space of vacua of some 3D n equals 4 theory. I'm not aware of any examples of things that don't have that property, but there could be. So for any case of that, and then also, in principle, these elements of H2 that classify the solutions, there's some physical values for those. And I don't know how to predict those. But a priori, the prediction I have is that for some physical values of these, for the physical hyperkähler cones, there exists some basis with these properties. That there should be any such basis ever is not obvious, I think, except for in very special cases. So it's not obvious that there should be any, but once you have some, it's also not obvious that there shouldn't be infinitely many. So that requires some work that I don't know how to do, but there's some story there. And that sort of completes the formal problem, and then I can just report what sorts of data comes out when you like play with examples that give some indication that these are sort of striking the right balance where these constraints are strong enough to not admit infinitely many solutions, but weak enough to admit solutions. So the first case, the first class of examples that I know how to say something about are the case where M is a minimal nilpotent orbit of some simple Lie algebra G. These are extraordinarily special cases because, so first of all, these spaces have G symmetry, or I should say, big G symmetry. And that means that if I'm worried about these kinds of changes of basis that were going to ruin my life before, I only have to worry about changes of basis which are compatible with big G symmetry. But actually, there are none, because it turns out that there's just one function in, there's not one in each representation. But there are no pairs of functions that live in the same representation of G that are not related to each other by G symmetry. So there's no changes of basis to worry about. So there's no changes of basis. It also happens that this, I should have called this the truncation condition. And the truncation is automatic, again, by G selection rules. And then, amazingly, in these cases, there were some heroes who actually wrote down all the structure constants for these algebras. They were able to derive them somehow. And they're unique for, so this is for G not in the AN series. There's no resolution of these things. And so there's no family of quantizations, so then it's just purely unique. And then this parity condition, or evenness condition, implies uniqueness for G in A n greater than 1. And then for A1, there's a family. So this is the condition for things that satisfy the evenness condition and the truncation condition, and then there's a prediction, which you can then verify, which turns out to have already been known in this heroic literature, that this unitarity condition does hold. In these cases, for everything, in this case, for half of the cases. So there's this element of H2, which is either a positive or a negative multiple of some basic element. And for the for positive, you get unitarity. For negative, you don't. So in this case, my conditions didn't do much. But that was because there was no gauge symmetry in the first place. And then there's a second class of examples that I've been able to experiment with, which are C2 mod gamma, where gamma is a finite subgroup of SU2. So these are so-called Kleinian singularities. C2 mod Z2 is a special case that lives in both of these families. For the other cases, they're separate. And I've really done the experiments with C2 mod Zn. I haven't tried the D or E series. And in these cases, you get weird-looking, surprising results. So in particular, in these cases, evenness plus truncation gives a finite dimensional space of solutions. So this cuts down from an infinite dimensional gauge symmetry to some finite dimensional ambiguity. And then unitarity, I don't know how to impose it in general, because I don't know how to actually solve for the structure constants of these algebras in general. But you can put it on a computer and impose it for many cases. So you can start imposing this positivity for f's of degree less than some number. You do this on a computer. And you get funny subspaces. So for example, for C2 mod Z3, there's a two-dimensional space of solutions. And the space of solutions that obeys unitarity looks like this, where this appears to go to infinity. But this is a finite dimensional approximation of the unitarity condition. In principle, there's going to be infinitely many more unitarity constraints, and who knows what sort of shape it turns into. And this is appears to be a difficult question. But maybe there's structure. The axes here are two random OPE coefficients that I chose to parameterize things in terms of. If you do it in a slightly different one, so you can do it in the case where you put the period on one axis and some other OPE coefficient, which is not the period but parameterizes the ambiguity in the basis on the other side, then you get a really weird looking shape. That region. So apparently, for any value of the period of one sine, there's some weird subspace of cases. And you shouldn't really allow this because this would be a norm going to zero. So that part along the axis is excluded.
And in general, it's a multi-dimensional.
The period is. This is for C2 mod Z3. For other cases, it's more numerically intensive to try to get things, and so I don't know.
It might be that the fact that it's dimensional is something that was not before, or is that the result of a calculation?
No, it's the result of a calculation. So the fact
not
that. So the fact that the dimensionality of this period space that corresponds to the different invariant algebras, that's one dimensional. Or this is the periods that are compatible with this evenness constraint. So that's one dimensional. These ones? Let's see. I'm not sure. I can check. I don't know. But I suspect that they don't, because I suspect that they're actually going to continue to change. I mean, at some point, all this was allowed. And then suddenly there was a new constraint coming from imposing one of these unitarity conditions that cuts out all this stuff. So there can be big, big modifications in the shape of the allowed region.
Does it make sense to ask which unitarity conditions that they're cutting
into? You can ask, and I could figure out the answer for you eventually. But there is some systematic, there's something to it. Like, you sort of like get things that change the shape of this piece from certain, from guys with like large, with like highest U1 charge available, and weird things like that. But it's a totally mysterious experimental game at the moment, and I don't know how to do anything analytically, because I don't know what technology could be implemented to solve these things. Okay, that's basically it. I mean, this is the state of affairs. It's in progress, but also I don't really know what is the thing that one is supposed to do. I think that there's an interesting prediction here, just at the level of mathematics, which is that there are these almost canonical bases for these non-commutative algebras. Maybe even canonical. I mean, who knows? Maybe the shape of this thing will become, you know, like this line plus this line at infinite precision. It's hard to say. But there's at least finite dimensional spaces of families of bases, which have this property. Whereas I think that, I don't think there's a way to guess. I don't think that in the general case there's another mechanism for killing an infinite amount of the gauge symmetry without necessarily killing everything.
There's also this prediction that the CFT gives you a distinguished period inside H2.
That's right. So I mentioned that there's some notion of a physical value of the period, and I don't.
Which is apparently some crazy thing involving pi.
Do you know how does it look there?
I didn't do it yet.
So the one, I guess, doing mock numerics, so it is the.
No, I stopped because I didn't know how to. I mean, it got to the point where where actually solving these conditions analytically in terms of these variables that are on the axes would take asymptotically long, and so instead I started doing things where I would just do things numerically point by point on a cluster in order to allow them or exclude them. Mm-hmm. And like, you can play that game forever and you can get wrapped up in doing numerics on a cluster, I know. But like, where do you stop? I don't see an end. The problem with these unitarity constraints is I don't see an endpoint in sight. So I think it's a hard question. But there's something there. No. So this is something that Tudor mentioned. So, there may be a way to do more. Davide was suggesting there might be a way to do more. But using existing technology, just that exists and has been published, there's a way to do certain localization calculations in these 3D theories when you have a construction as a gauge theory, in order to get certain very special instances of these structure constants. In particular, you can get some of the two-point functions of very special operators. Now, it's very limited how many you can do, but you can do some. And if you do it for this C2 mod Z3 case, and you measure that two-point function, you get a number which is like a rational number plus pi squared times another rational number.
Uniform.
So, not an integer. I don't know. You tell me what the conditions are. You mean? I don't think that these OPE coefficients are measuring the dimension of a vector space. Yeah. I mean, these local operators can certainly come from line operators in four dimensions, but these are not, I mean, these pi's are not dimensions of.
There is no way to extend this to a higher dimensional setup while keeping conformal symmetry.
I agree.
Thank you.